I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Who is Deep Throat? It's an all-American mystery up there with Who Shot J.R. and Where They Buried Jimmy Hoffa. Our guest, Leonard Garman, says he has solved the Deep Throat puzzle. In a new book, he reveals the identity of that shadowy character known to lots of us as Hal Holbrook in the Hollywood version of the Woodward and Bernstein story, All the President's Men. Leonard Garment was Richard Nixon's lawyer after John Dean resigned during the dark days of Watergate. He was a Washington insider, oblivious, he says, to Deep Throat's identity until the 1990s, when he began writing a memoir of his days in the Nixon White House and got hooked. Compared to deep space and eternity, the identity of Deep Throat is just a minor league mystery, he writes, but for a quarter of a century, it's been a durable sense of wonder. If we find him, we will experience the particular sort of satisfaction we feel when we have tied up one of the loose ends of the universe. So Leonard Garman writes, Connection listeners, have you been losing sleep over the mystery of Deep Throat? Do you have your own guess as to who it is? It's convention week in Philadelphia. What if it was the patriarch himself, George H.W. Bush? What if it was a composite of all the president's men? Does it even matter at this point? Leonard Garment says there have been consequences here for American politics and government. He also says there's a key in this story to the enduring mystery of Richard Nixon. 1-800-423-8255. But 1-800-423-TALK solves the problem of Deep Throat. 1-800-423-8255. The Deep Throat connection with the author, Leonard Garment. Fess up, Leonard Garment. Who done it?
That's a terrific introduction to whatever I have.
Well, it's
to
a
say.
Terrific book.
Well, you're a terrific guy. Well, why don't we leave
I was
it all
there too. I know who it was, and it's
which
your.
Garage
it's not
were
your.
You in?
It's not your. Who you're a guy, but go ahead. Make the case.
The case is made in the book, in detail, and to summarize it, I looked and looked and read and had breakfast, lunch, and dinner with everybody who could conceivably fit the part. I knew all of these people. I hired a lot of them. I've been in sort of the Nixon whirlpool of comebacks and decline and fall and what have you. And the conclusion I reached with this less than magnificent obsession of mine was that the young lawyer who I hired in 1964 at the Nixon Mudge law firm when I was running the litigation department, who went on to be a key member of the comeback team, who was in the government briefly as deputy counsel to John Ehrlichman, who moved next door to become a private lawyer who prowled the halls of the executive office building and had the best access to information and the best motive to retaliate for being wiretapped and followed by the FBI. John Sears, who then went on to become campaign manager for Ronald Reagan's two runs for the presidency. That is the man, and I make the case. I don't have DNA proof. Nobody has. The only ones who have absolute unchallengeable knowledge would be Deep Throat himself or itself and Woodward and Bernstein and Ben Bradley. But I think I've made a case that's satisfactory to me until really, at this point, until they come forward with something more than simple denials. I mean, I think 26, 27 years, it's time for the journalists to tell the public, to satisfy the public interest in information.
But the journalists have told us, and they've told us it's not your guy. They've told us it's not John Sears. And John Sears, in it, what sounds like a sort of friendly anger, has threatened to sue you for naming him. But let's stick with the John Sears thing for a moment.
Okay,
I know John
fine.
Sears well. He... very, very clever, conspiratorial, Nixon-esque, strategic, four-dimensional mind. He also smokes.
Drinks scotch.
And drank enough to qualify. But let's talk, as the lawyers always do in a trial, about the...
You have to reveal your sources, Christopher.
Well,
no, I'm kidding.
I covered him, especially anything. When he was managing Ronald Reagan to that 76 convention in Kansas City. And with a lot of bluff and brilliance, made it look close.
Kept it alive, right.
Yeah, but let's go back here. The means, the motive, the opportunity. Why do you indict and then convict this suspect?
Well, I don't
talk about his
means,
his motive, and his opportunity.
I don't think it's an indictment or a conviction in the denigrative terms that that suggested by indictment, accusation, indictment, and conviction. I think that there are some people who have occupied intimate positions in a neutral sense with the insiders, factual insiders of the Nixon administration, who had access. He did. Opportunity, he did. A close connection with the Washington Post apparatus, he admittedly did, with as a source for Carl Bernstein, regular phone calls to him, to that is to John Sears, to obtain guidance about Watergate. Motive, he had both a motive of a political strategist, somebody who would look for vindication, or shall we say revenge, for having been wiretapped in 1969, mm-hmm. followed by a fleet of FBI agents 24 hours a day for 3 months, and then pushed out of the administration. Now, he didn't fall. He didn't jump. He was pushed. And plus a kind of a fundamental decency that John had, at least as I knew him, about the business of government. He was both a hard-boiled strategist and something of a philosophical dreamer about the possibilities of politics. Mm. And the excitement of going into a garage and not having to pay for parking in Washington to talk to Bob Woodward.
This, just to start with, the flaws in the argument, John Sears ate publicly with innumerable journalists all his career and drank copiously on New York Times and the network expense accounts. It didn't seem to me like him to go into hiding. But let's go back one step. Let's remember what Deep Throat did and didn't do. He didn't say, here's exactly what happened. He stood back and said, let me explain to you guys, Wood and Bernstein, the general shape of the Nixon White House, the rivalries, the currency, the organization, the spirit of Nixon's mind. And he would keep saying, you're warm. No, that doesn't quite make sense. This is the shape of it. I remember that period well. William Safire had just come to the New York Times Bureau, and we used him as well as we could to say, you know, who talked to whom and who didn't, and where was the money, and and what did this kind of thing matter?
Well, that's exactly, I think that's very insightful, Chris, if I can be to play. Please don't call me Mr. Garment. Just call me Leonard Garment, or Len, or you. Only my children call me Mr. Garment. That's John Sears you've described, somebody who had that kind of four-dimensional perspective on the Nixon administration. The insiders, the throat cutters, the backstabbers. It takes somebody with that kind of perception of politics and internal behavior like John Sears to provide guidance and to keep the game going from time to time.
But let's remember the complexity of motives, too. Everybody in that game knew that they were at risk of indictment, of disgrace, of ruination, and they were trying to manipulate the conversation. There was a Mitchell faction, there was the Haldeman faction, and everybody was trying to sort of spill a little problem on somebody else.
There were multiple sources for All the President's Men, the book, the movie, the opera, the saga, the cartoon.
But I just want to say there was also a mix of motives. Deep Throat was trying to explain something to the truth, probably protect some people, but get at something that had been lost in American government. And even in the Nixon career, there was a kind of poignancy, a regret.
Well, that sounds like John Sears. I mean, you know him, and you know the situation, obviously, with greater depth than all the good interviews that have been done so far. Nobody has really put this issue quite in that informed framework. Can you come up with somebody other than John Sears?
Yes, ultimately to a composite, but frankly, I thought Chuck Colson was always a good candidate.
Well, Sears has said that he said to Mike Wallace.
It was Colson.
that it was Colson.
Colson says it
and
was
Colson
Sears.
And Colson said it was Sears.
I think, in fact,
the game goes on.
I think it was Colson's law partner. I believe he went to law school with you, David Shapiro.
David Shapiro? No, he doesn't. He wouldn't fit through the door of the garage.
Sure he would. And he had this kind of a mind. He understood Colson. He was trying to think, how in the world did I go into partnership with a guy who's up to his neck in trouble now? But he studied Colson. He knew Colson's version of the rivalry. And he talked. He talked to me. He talked to Cy Hirsch. He talked to Bernstein at 2 o'clock in the morning.
David Shapiro talked to everybody. I mean, I know that. But he didn't have... He didn't have the information. He didn't have the...
He knew what Colson knew.
Well, he knew what Colson knew, but he didn't have... He wasn't anything like the character, personality that was described in All the President's Men. If it's David Shapiro, then the book is a three-quarter hoax.
Which book?
All the President's Men, if he's Deep Throat.
Why?
Is that what you're saying, that David Shapiro was Deep Throat?
Well, first of all, I think they made up the persona of Deep Throat.
You think it's a composite?
I think it's a composite, and it's not to fool the reader.
Well, I didn't play the game that way.
Let me just explain what I think they did.
Sure.
Ben Bradley said, where in the world are you getting this? And
you wouldn't tell
me. And I have
Ben
to
Bradley.
Answer to Kay Graham. And what they said, listen, we have it solid, and we have it solid from many, many sources, and we're getting this sort of general picture of the Nixon landscape, mm-hmm. and we can't betray any one of our sources. We're going to have to call it one guy, and we'll invent this scotch-drinking heavy smoker in the trench coat, but I can't believe it was any one person.
Chris, that would be a journalistic fraud of monumental proportions. You and I know that. And if Ben Bradley went for that composite ball of wax, then they ought to give back the Pulitzer.
Deep Throat, named for Linda Lovelace in a
movie,
the big pornographic right. movie of the period, was another way of saying this is a kind of abstraction. No,
no, that was Howard Simons, who had a very picaresque sense of humor, and when young Bob Woodward, I guess age 28 at that time, 28 or 29, was saying, my friend told me this, my friend told me that. Howard Simons said, well, let's just call him, he sounds like Deep Throat. And Deep Throat was sort of the internal newsroom shorthand for my friend, or my friends, if your theory is right. I don't think it is.
Well, it's
easy. And that stuck. And then, you know, the very good editor at Simon & Schuster suggested that Deep Throat sounded like a very interesting way of describing the source, the dominant source.
But didn't Alice Mayhew at Simon & Schuster...
Alice Mayhew.
Sorry, didn't she decide that it was a composite?
Well, she said that to John Dean at some point. She thought it was a composite, but she didn't know. And I mean, to say, it may be a larger story than the one, my identification of John Sears' Deep Throat. It may be a larger story that you're suggesting, which is that it was a huge hoax.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Deep Throat connection. Leonard Garment may, in fact, have written this just to take the heat off himself. On the other hand, there's this whole question about why wouldn't somebody be claiming credit? John Sears says, I deny the charge. What if he said, I can't take credit for this? Do we think of this person, even now, and I put this to connection listeners, as the saintly whistleblower, as the sort of broken-hearted Nixon co-conspirator, or do we think of it as a sort of Judas figure who sort of, there were no 30 pieces of silver, but was it a kind of betrayal from
all
the inside? there's a composite right there.
Well, because life is a composite.
What does that mean?
Well, that it's complicated. There is this, the complexity of motivations, complexity of a number of people who have a number of routes to a particular piece of information. But we finally have to, I mean, there's no point to any of this if the whole thing was made up. If there was a cover-up by Bob and Carl of a central, of a collection of sources and lumped together as one Deep Throat. Then the book was a fake. And the,
it doesn't make it a fake. They say, by calling it Deep Throat, by saying they won't reveal it, they're sort of saying, you know, don't pull the curtain on the Wizard of Oz here.
Tell that to the Pulitzer Committee that gave this book the Pulitzer Prize, or gave it to the Washington Post, however it was arranged. Mm-hmm. I mean, the essence of the story is a kind of an archetypal figure, the Greek narrator, said over and over again in every conceivable form that it was one person, by Bob and Woodward and Carl Bernstein. If it turns out to be a composite of persons without this central dominant figure narrating the complicated pieces of this puzzle, then it's an interesting piece of fiction, but it's fiction rather than fact. It's drama rather than
it journal. Had a very factual result. Let me just put one more question here.
There were a lot of other tributary streams to that outcome.
If indeed this was a single person, it seems to me we would have nailed it pretty easily. I mean, just sort of sort out the scotch drinkers in the Nixon crowd, sort out the smokers and the non-smokers. I mean, he's sort out the kinds of people that appear in places like this, and it would be, and it, as you say, it was not going to be Henry Kissinger.
It's not going to be Henry Kissinger, but, you know, I considered all of that, and, you know, it is conceivable. There's a lot of things that are conceivable, including various suspects acting through cutouts. Who were in the government and who occupied high sensitive positions, but were carrying, executing a mission for still higher stakes for a higher official. Dwell on that for a while. I don't want to get into that and to complicate
the
simpler message of the book.
Well, let's get to the message. I mean, you've got this bee in your bonnet, and you've stuck with it admirably, I must say. Why does it matter to the world just what Deep Throat did, and then who he might be?
Mm-hmm. Because Deep Throat and all the president's men and Watergate are meta figures and meta scenarios of a passage in American history that has shaped our politics through the intervening years, shaped the present politics and politics for the indefinite future. And so there's an important piece of this portrait of the puzzle that's missing, and we should know who it is by now. I mean, I was just fascinated by all the implications of this riddle, puzzle, if you will. And I think that it is now more history than journalism. I think that the confidentiality that the that Bob and Carl promised to their secret source, Deep Throat, it was admirably adhered to for the early years, but now it's history rather than journalism, and I think they should come forward and tell us who it is.
It's very instructive. I mean, even if you're only 99% right or only 9% right, it's deeply instructive to see the way a sort of a presidential conspiracy works. It's lawyers, it's young folk, it's there is money involved, there is region, every kind of, I mean, it is, there's a bit of the Iliad about it. All these egos, all these interests, all these layers of trust and distrust and memory around a guy, in Nixon's case, who thrived on it in a strange way.
He was one of the recipients of the parcels of power that Richard Nixon distributed to extremely different people. And Nixon held the strings on that through his comeback campaign, his election in 68, and the first term. And then it all came apart.
It is much more like a the way we think of a sort of a mafia family working. I don't mean to.
No, that's not.
Nice. No. I don't need to call him a mafioso either or a godfather. But the history of this band of brothers, if you want to put a blessing on it, or a gang, if you want to sort of describe the way these sort of freelance political teams work, is very interesting. And I suspect they're all more like this, including the Clinton or Kennedy or George W.
All of them.
Yeah, exactly. question before we go to the phone.
But the stakes.
Why does everybody let George Herbert Walker Bush off the hook? He was Nixon's. He came back to be Nixon's party chairman in this period, only to have the Watergate thing blow up in his face. He was ambitious. He was a Nixon guy, regretful, hoping to secure a future career. Why shouldn't he have been somebody who would have been thinking through a rationale of what in the world was going on here and want to share it to get it over with?
Well, I'm sure he was thinking about this. Everybody was thinking about it. But he didn't have access access to the finite information that was passed by Deep Throat to Bob Woodward. And Carl Bernstein was the recipient from the John Sears side of Deep Throat, admittedly so. I mean, John admitted to me when I told him that I had concluded that he was Deep Throat. Of course, he denied that. I anticipated that in the manuscript of the book at that point, that he would deny it. But he very spontaneously said, well, I talked to Carl Bernstein. And when you read the passages of all the president's men that referred to the information that the former administration official gave to Carl Bernstein, it's quintessential Deep Throat material. And John Sears was my candidate in the manuscript of the book because he did provide that information to Carl.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Deep Throat connection with Leonard Garment, who's been in search of Deep Throat and says he's nailed him. John Sears. Joseph is on the line from Plaistow, New Hampshire.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good, Joseph.
A couple of points. I recollect over the last many years, on a few occasions, hearing both Bob Woodward and on different occasions...
Carl Bernstein.
No, the publisher of the paper, not Mrs. Graham, the editor, Ben Bradley.
Ben Bradley.
Both state in one way or another that the arrangement or agreement with this individual is that upon his death, they will reveal who he is.
Well, they say when he dies. Now, when he dies, they will reveal who he is, or if he consents before he dies.
Right.
Now, when he dies could turn out to be 2 or 3 years of book writing. If he's dead, they have a monopoly of complete monopoly on the information. And that's not journalism that they're monopolizing. It's a piece of history. Before he dies, we should have that information so we have the corrective of Deep Throat himself to deal with what they have to say. I mean, it's ridiculous.
After
26 years to make this a Washington Post, Carl Bernstein, Bob Woodward secret.
The second issue that Chris raises in terms of the morality of it, I think that whenever one deals with informants and subterfuge and secrecy, whether it be Chris and the issues in the federal courts that you've touched on several times over the last few years, it's wrought with betrayal. But on this in particular, I don't see how one could make this person out to be a saintly person. I think if one's hands are clean and one's conscience is clear, and one is a public official, a public servant, and is aware of widespread or systemic illegality or abuse, that it's incumbent upon them one can do several things. One can resign and absent himself from it. One can go to the authorities and report it. But it seems to me like this person, and I know Mr. Garment himself was heavily involved at the time. I sat transfixed by it all because Richard Nixon was the first president I ever voted for, and incidentally, I don't ever regret the vote, frankly.
Mm-hmm. I was transfixed also.
and I can remember just sitting and watching it, and I know how hard and loyal you both attempted to serve the president on the one hand and do the honorable thing on the other, and I I think that may be the unwritten story of it all, that not just you, but there were others that attempted to serve the president and did so honorably.
Well, I've tried. That's, let's say, a worthy comment, and I've tried to deal with that issue and with the complexity of of Deep Throat's motivations, the many aspects of it, and how it comes out, and why he may be lying doggo for a quarter of a century, because, and it's one of the reasons why I conclude without DNA and eyewitness identification, that's not available, why I conclude that it's John Sears, because John is still close to the Republican leadership, to Trent Lott and to people of that sort. I mean, I shouldn't say of that sort. It sounds like ilk, and of that ilk. But John has his own reasons for continuing to deny the role.
Well, I wonder. I mean, there's a big publisher.
This is not Chris Lydon, right?
Yes, there's a big publisher's advance waiting for him, and all of 60 Minutes, if he wants it, to talk about how he did it and why. John Sears is a very complicated thinker. I just wonder why, even to this day, he thinks of it as a charge, not a boast. But we'll come to that. Leonard Garment is our guest. He's written a book about his own obsession as to who was Deep Throat, who gave away the Watergate secret. Leonard Garment, the man who we haven't mentioned this yet, but he invented Alan Greenspan. He also brought Duke Ellington to play at the Nixon White House. Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. The Deep Throat mystery solved, he says, by Leonard Garment. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com.
The great mysteries of the 20th century pertains to the identity of Deep Throat, the inside source who leaked the information to the Washington Post. Who is Deep Throat? Tonight, my guests will answer that question. Bob Woodward, Carl Bernstein, the Post reporters who wrote the story oh so many years ago. Good to see you. Nice to have you here.
Hi there. Thank you for having us.
Yes. Let's just get right to it. Who is Deep Throat?
Well, first of all, we're not telling you.
You know, you guys are getting pretty old now.
So what's your point with that?
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, are you ever going to tell anybody who Deep Throat is before you die?
Well, a lot bigger names than you have asked us who Deep Throat is, so... Mm-hmm.
I don't think we revealed on a little tiny show like this one here.
Yeah. You know what I think? I mean, I'm just going to come right out and say it. I don't think there is any such person as Deep Throat. I think y'all just made it up.
Yes, there is. Deep Throat...
Don't say it! He's trying to trick us!
That could be the movie version of your book, Leonard Garment.
what was that? Chris Lydon.
That's the mighty. I'd love to say that's the Mighty Connection Art Players, but in fact, it's from a little movie that we know all about called Dick.
Oh, that tastefully titled movie.
Yeah,
but as in anything goes.
Dick Nixon before Nixon dicks you, or something like that.
That's right.
Leonard Garment is our guest. He's the author of a book called In Search of Deep Throat, The Greatest Political Mystery of Our Time. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Deep Throat connection. B is on the line.
Hello.
Welcome, B.
Hi. I just wanted to make this comment that I really feel like the Washington Post is doing the admirable thing by not revealing who Deep Throat is, because, you know, when you make that kind of a promise to a source, especially over such huge information, it's like a sacred trust, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's a statement, or it's an implied question. B, if I may call you B, it's a quarter of a century now. He's still alive. We all hang by a thread, and a large part of history will disappear with his death, at least the ability to confirm the validity of a lot of the things that were said in the book and the movie. that formed the legend of Deep Throat, formed a large part of American history, I think the country's entitled to know. The function of journalism is to inform, and part of that is maintaining the confidentiality of a source when that's the condition. But after a quarter of a century, I think the tension between informing and maintaining the privacy or confidentiality of a source is in acute tension. And I come out in favor of disclosure, since that's supposed to be the journalist's game.
There's a statute of limitations on every off-the-record agreement. I agree with you, and there's every reason in a certain way to get clear about it. But just change the focus a little bit, Len Garment. Imagine you're right. Let's suppose you're entirely right that it was John Sears. We still need to know more what that means, why this character would have been where he was, what would have driven him, and who John Sears stacks up to be in the history
of
these times.
Those are all good, relevant questions.
For people who didn't know him at all, begin at the beginning. A guy from from upstate New York, went to Notre Dame. Tell us the John Sears story.
Okay. Chris, for 10 seconds before I start the John Sears story, visualize that this is a framework. The search was a framework in which I sort of went back to review that part of American history and wrote the story of that time of history. And so that the search provided the connecting threads for a review of an important time in American history. Okay, John Sears. John Sears came to my office from Dewey Ballantyne, Tom Dewey's old law firm, in quest of a job, in search of employment. And this was in 1964. I was very impressed by this young, shiny-faced young man. Knew a lot. Seemed to know a lot more than his years would support. We talked about law, we talked about litigation, we talked about politics. And when it came to politics, the room lit up with his intelligence and insights. He was a young fellow. I took him around to Richard Nixon, who was my partner then, and was starting what I thought to be another quest of the presidency. And he and John talked for a bit. And when we finished up, either then or subsequently, my phone, he said, well, I really think we ought to try to hire that fellow and put him into the litigation department. Well, I hired him, and he was in the litigation department working with me on some cases, but he quickly was drawn into into Nixon's campaign, his quiet campaign effort. And he, together with
Pat Buchanan
and Rosemary Woods.
And Bill Sapphire.
Well, yeah, Bill Sapphire. Those were the four or five people who were the intellectual or the ideological side of Richard Nixon's comeback campaign. The writers.
What part did thinkers. John Sears identify with? I mean, was it the scheming
strategy,
most of all?
Yeah, scheming and dreaming. My Jesse Jackson intervention. He was part of. He was very close to Rosemary Woods, who was very close to the candidate, or the whatever he was called at that point, and spent a lot of nights, evenings with me, evenings into 2-3 o'clock in the morning, talking politics, talking philosophy, talking theology, the smoke curling from his ever-present cigarette, the aroma from
Paul
my Malls, scotch
as
bottle.
I recall, yeah, unfiltered rope, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So... he went on from there to play a central role in Nixon's comeback campaign. And then he came to Washington with Richard Nixon. But by then, John Mitchell and Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman had taken over the campaign and had taken over the formation of the administration of the Nixon presidency. And John Sears didn't fit, because John Sears was a talker, thinker, strategist, so that he was competitive with John Mitchell and competitive with Haldeman. John Ehrlichman was a slightly different story. John Ehrlichman was there to handle a lot of the campaign and early organizational efforts of the presidency. I thought John Ehrlichman he played a very constructive role in domestic affairs and helped me get a lot of things done for which I've gotten credit, but which would not have happened but for Ehrlichman. But in any event, he was there and dependent upon the president and Mitchell and Colson and Haldeman. And so he did his part.
It's still unclear to me, I must say.
And John Sears was doomed almost from the outset.
Why? He was a generation.
Because he talked to the press. Hmm. Simple. That one is singularly one reason. I mean, he talked to the press.
He strikes me as a version. How would you relate John Sears to another great survivor from that period, Kevin Phillips, who had the same kind of deeply intellectual strain? He was attached to Nixon, but he had a mind of his own. He fit rather neatly into John Mitchell's world. He invented the Southern strategy. He knew
politics. Kevin Phillips wasn't even in the government.
Well, he was in the campaign. He was a compartment of John Mitchell's head, and he didn't threaten John Mitchell. I don't see why Sears did either, because they were both a completely generation younger. Mitchell was a kind of father figure to Nixon. John, there seemed to be plenty of room for John Sears as a son.
John Sears managed to fix his own wagon by being fairly condescending towards John Mitchell. And in on the merits, I think he had it right that John Mitchell was in over his head as the super campaign manager, determinant of policies and practices, and attorney general. And from that, from early on, I think John Mitchell saw John Sears as sort of a threat because he was a protege of the president, a kind of a son. So that when the opportunity presented itself to push John out of a position of power as a political advisor in the White House, John Mitchell was happy to take advantage of that. And what he got instead of John Sears was Chuck Colson. And thereby hangs another part of this multifaceted story, which is the story of American. It's a real important part of American history.
This is Chuck Colson when he was a sort of
running over my grandmother.
Yeah, Marine
and
Corps.
And running back and forth over my grandmother's
body. Before he discovered Jesus.
Well, you know.
Some people have said Jesus is his Nixon substitute. That's another whole matter. But I just want to ask you about John. If it was John Sears, would he have entered into the role of Deep Throat more in sorrow about Nixon or more in anger, do you think?
Somebody waved at me passing through the studio here. Can you repeat that question?
Well, did Sears take on this mission more in sorrow or in anger with respect to Nixon? Was he getting even, or was he trying to rescue the good Nixon he'd campaigned with in 66, 7, and 8?
Well, that's the question that Woodward and Bernstein posed for themselves in All the President's Men. Why was he doling out the information? Why was he only a guide through this Disneyland of politics? Why wouldn't he just come out and tell them everything? And at the end of they speculated, well, maybe he liked the excitement of keeping the game going. Maybe he this, maybe that. And they concluded that he was trying to save the presidency and save Richard Nixon by doing it gradually and letting it come to his attention that he was in real trouble with the cover-up, and maybe he would. It's kind of a Hail Mary pass.
Leonard Garman, stand by for callers. 1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone, the Deep Throat connection. Jerry is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Welcome, Jerry.
I read some years ago, must be at least 10, what I thought was an excellent spy story or mystery by the same John Ehrlichman that you're talking about, which he called The Company, and it was a disguised accounting of events, or a monocle based on the break-in and the plumbers and all that sort of stuff. And I've forgotten exactly what his
Richard Helms, right, sort of a Richard Helms type, right, head of the CIA company.
Right, and the title of the book, The Company, he was talking about the CIA and so on. But anyway, I wondered if either you or Chris have read that over recently and have reflected on whether there are any valuable clues that Ehrlichman may have dropped in that. I imagine he knew a great deal about what was going on, and he may have, and it seems like he used a fair amount of insider knowledge just writing it, which is one thing that makes it so interesting and so intriguing. And
I haven't read it, Jerry. What did Ehrlichman know, and when did he know it, Leonard Garment?
Well, Ehrlichman knew a lot, but like everybody else, he didn't know everything. And that included Richard Nixon. There were furies set loose by Watergate, furies of revenge, furies of anxiety. And they passed each other in the hallways. They communicated on the telephone. They met in the men's room. Mm-hmm. And Richard Nixon, I don't think, had... a large part of the story of what was going on.
Could the CIA
and
have been...
And what he had set loose.
Could it have been a CIA thing, not Watergate, but Deep Throat?
Well, that's one of the dominant theories over the years, that the CIA had booby-trapped the White House and had posted people, a person. In fact, I think there are several books... that say, and some that suggest that Alex Butterfield was a CIA plant in the White House. He occupied a high position he was one of McNamara's assistants in the Johnson administration.
He was the one who revealed the tapes in the end.
He called in from somewhere from Hawaii to Bob Haldeman, the old college pal of his, and asked to be considered as Haldeman's assistant. And there is the theory, and people have said, I can't identify them because I don't know exactly who they are, if they would come forward. I mean, or if I remembered, I would probably blab who their names. But Alex Butterfield is said to have had that kind of relationship because he was an intelligence officer.
Leonard Garment, you knew Nixon well after his presidency. Did he have a theory about the identity of Deep Throat?
We had various theories, including somebody named Noble Mellencamp, who was a paper receiving and paper disseminating functionary in the White House, and such a wonderful name that it must have struck Nixon that only somebody with the name Noble Mellencamp could perform the majestic function of cutting him off at the knees.
Was he Nixon's candidate? I mean, for Deep Throat?
For a split second or two. And when I saw Senator Robert Bennett for breakfast, that's one of the little stories in the book, because he was a major candidate of mine and of Anthony Lucas of the New York Times way back, and of other people. Mm. This is the very tall Senator Robert Bennett, who was running a public relations company at the time of Watergate.
Not to be confused with President Clinton's Monica Gate lawyer, but go ahead.
Right. This is Robert F. Bennett, senator from Utah, very smart. At the time of Watergate, he was running a public relations firm that was also a CIA front, he testified and acknowledged that he had this relationship with the CIA, and that he did talk to Bob Woodward and conveyed him just about everything he knew, everything he knew about Watergate, which was a lot. So he was my principal candidate until I started writing and just came up against the hard resistance of my own sense of who and what Deep Throat was.
1-800-423-8255. The Deep Throat connection. Torbett is calling from York, Maine.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Welcome, Torbett.
I would just like to add one salient fact to the possibility that the entire operation was, in fact, an intelligence operation, and that has to do with the backing up the concept that Butterfield was Deep Throat. And there are only two real reasons why we know about Watergate and Nixon's stonewalling behind it. And One of them is the aforementioned existence of the White House taping system, which Butterfield did reveal. The other one is that James McCord, who was inexplicably involved in what otherwise seemed to be a kind of a hodgepodge of paraprofessional Cubans and who knows what at the actual site of the burglary, inexplicably left tape across the door. And this is a man who was very, very experienced operative in the Cold War theater of Europe, presumably at the highest standards of professionalism, somehow left tape across the door so that the now famous security guard, whose name escapes me, was able to discover the burglary. Mm. And
let's hear it for long memories. God, these details are so vivid. You left out Judge John Sirica. I mean, it was his sentencing order that told James McCord.
Chris, are you saying that to me? That I left out John Sirica?
No. Torbett left out John Sirica. But anyway.
I see. Okay.
All these details. Can I just say, I mean, I think the most interesting thing about this book is its portrayal of what it takes to run a national conspiracy that we call the White House. And this brings it all back.
That's what I tried. I tried to write about larger themes, but through the concrete business of Watergate, Deep Throat, Bowl of Presidents.
Stand by for some more calls. Howard is on the line. Hello, Howard.
Hi, Chris.
Welcome.
I just wanted to make a comment relative to the average citizen. I've been listening fascinated. It's a fascinating subject, obviously, but I've been listening to you guys talking about all these notaries and lawyers and all these people who comprise the Nixon White House, and I guess we don't know them that well. So if Deep Throat was to be revealed, just a name wouldn't help me. I'd need to know a lot more about him. In fact, I'd like to hear from himself. You know, why doesn't he publish a book? Maybe in cooperation with Woodward and Bernstein, and tell us all. Tell us what he was thinking, how he was doing it, who he is, and all that stuff.
You have just said something very interesting, and this is the... I don't know whether I'm doing something that's naughty, but I have a copy of...
Go right ahead.
This coming chronicle. Go right ahead. Get yourself in trouble. The New York Times Sunday Book Review...
big blowout. You're a page
leads, one. Leads with I don't know how this happened to me. Leads with search. Should we call it that for short, or should we call it throat? Which is better, Chris? You tell me. In search of Deep Throat. Anyway, that's
call
the lead
throat.
Review. Call it Deep Throat. Okay. And it concludes. It's Michael Oreskes wrote the review. It's a five-column review that I couldn't write if the New York Times had said to me, "You write the review of your own book, and we'll publish it under the title Deep, under the identification of Deep Throat." But it concludes by saying, "If John Sears, the thoughtful, even occasionally poetic believer in politics, was Deep Throat, let us hope he will leave us his own book on how he feels about the world he helped create." Well, I think that's exactly what the caller is raising. And I think instead of leaving us a postmortem book or leaving us a book for postmortem review, that he or John Sears, Woodward or Bernstein or Ben Bradley should come forward and tell us what it's all about.
Well, I think it'll become easier if the kind of general judgment settles that Deep Throat did us all a kind of service. This was an honorable, almost patriotic, rising above principle and personal loyalty to egg the truth into the general
light. Chris, I don't know whether you've had a chance to read the book.
I read it every word, indeed.
Okay, so then you know that it's a reasonable depiction of...
It's a wonderful reconstruction of an absolutely unforgettable and still instructive time in our lives. Thank you, Leonard Garment, for joining us, and thank you for the book. It's called In Search of Deep Throat. Thanks for help today from Michael Garth, Sam Vanderpoel, Asher Hawkins, Matt Lieber, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by co-conspirators Catherine Bidwell, Dan Furst, Hitesh Hathi, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jake Shapiro, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our senior conspirator. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.
I hear you want it. I'm about to hear you.
Give me the proof.
Give me the proof. Hey.
Give me the proof.
Give me the proof.
Hey.
Give me the proof. I got to have it. Got to have the proof.
Give me the proof.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR. Just ahead on Here and Now at Noon, in addition to the latest news, special reports on 355 sheep slated for execution because they may have contracted mad cow disease.